King, clergy, and nobles were compelled to submit to the atrocities of an excited and maddened people. Their thirst for revenge was only stimulated by the execution of the king, and those who had decreed his death soon followed him to the scaffold. A general slaughter of all suspected of hostility to the revolution was determined. The prisons were crowded, at one time containing more than 200,000 captives. The cities of the kingdom were filled with scenes of horror. One party of revolutionists was against another party, and France became a vast field of contending masses, swayed by the fury of their passions. In Paris, one tumult succeeded another, and the citizens were divided into a medley of factions that seemed intent on nothing but mutual extermination. And to add to the general misery, the nation became involved in a prolonged and devastating war with the great powers of Europe. The country was nearly bankrupt. The armies were clamoring for arrears of pay. The Parisians were starving. The provinces were laid waste by brigands, and civilization was almost extinguished in anarchy and license. All too well, the people had learned the lessons of cruelty and torture which Rome had so diligently taught. A day of retribution at last had come. It was not now the disciples of Jesus that were thrust into dungeons and dragged to the stake. Long ago these had perished or been driven into exile. Unsparing Rome now felt the deadly power of those whom she had trained to delight in deeds of blood. The example of persecution which the clergy of France had exhibited for so many ages was now retorted upon them with signal vigor. The scaffolds ran red with the blood of the priests. The galleys and the prisons, once covered with Huguenots, were now filled with their persecutors. Chained to the bench and toiling at the oar, the Roman Catholic clergy experienced all those woes which their church had so freely inflicted on the gentle heretics. Then came those days when the most barbarous of all codes was administered by the most barbarous of all tribunals. When no man could greet his neighbor or say his prayers without danger of committing a capital crime. When spies lurked in every corner. When the guillotine was long and hard at work every morning. When the jails were filled as close as the holds of a slave ship. When the gutters ran foaming with blood into the Seine, while the daily wagon loads of victims were carried to their doom through the streets of Paris. The proconsuls, whom the sovereigns committed had sent forth to the departments, revelled in an extravagance of cruelty unknown even to the capital. The knife of the deadly machine rose and fell, too slow for their work of slaughter. Long rows of captives were mowed down with grape shot. Holes were made in the bottom of crowded barges. Lyons were turned into a desert. At Arras, even the cruel mercy of a speedy death was denied to the prisoners. All down the Loire, from Saumur to the sea, great flocks of crows and kites feasted on naked corpses, twined together in hideous embraces. No mercy was shown to sex or age. The number of young lads and of girls of 17 who were murdered by the execrable government is to be reckoned by hundreds. Babies torn from the breast were tossed from pike to pike along the Jacobin ranks. In the short space of 10 years, multitudes of human beings perished. All this was as Satan would have it. This was what for ages he had been working to secure. His policy is deception from first to last, and his steadfast purpose is to bring woe and wretchedness upon men, to deface and defile the workmanship of God. to mar the divine purposes of benevolence and love, and thus cause grief in heaven. Then, by his deceptive arts, he blinds the minds of men and leads them to throw back the blame of his work upon God, as if all this misery were the result of the Creator's plan. In like manner, when those who have been degraded and brutalized through his cruel power achieve their freedom, he urges them on to excesses and atrocities. Then this picture of unbridled license is pointed out by tyrants and oppressors as an illustration of the results of liberty. When error in one garb has been detected, Satan only masks it in a different disguise, and multitudes receive it as eagerly as at the first. When the people found Romanism to be a deception, and he could not through this agency lead them to transgression of God's law, he urged them to regard all religion as a cheat, and the Bible as a fable, and, casting aside the divine statutes, they gave themselves up to unbridled iniquity. The fatal error which wrought such woe for the inhabitants of France was the ignoring of this one great truth, that true freedom lies within the prescriptions of the law of God. Oh, that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments! Then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. There is no peace, saith the Lord, unto the wicked. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, and shall be quiet from fear of evil. Atheists, infidels, and apostates oppose and denounce God's law, but the results of their influence prove that the well-being of man is bound up with his obedience of the divine statutes. Those who will not read the lessons from the book of God are bidden to read it in the history of nations. When Satan wrought through the Roman Church to lead men away from obedience, his agency was concealed, and his work was so disguised that the degradation and misery which resulted were not seen to be the fruit of transgression. And his power was so far contradicted by the working of the Spirit of God that his purposes were prevented from reaching their full fruition. The people did not trace the effect to its cause and discover the source of their miseries. But in the revolution, the law of God was openly set aside by the National Council, and in the reign of terror which followed, the working of cause and effect could be seen by all. When France publicly rejected God and set aside the Bible, wicked men and spirits of darkness exulted in their attainment of the object so long desired, a kingdom free from the restraints of the law of God. Because sentence against an evil work was not speedily executed, therefore the heart of the sons of men was fully set in them to do evil. But the transgression of a just and righteous law must inevitably result in misery and ruin. Though not visited at once with judgments, the wickedness of men was nevertheless surely working out their doom. Centuries of apostasy and crime had been treasuring up wrath against the day of retribution, and when their iniquity was full, the despisers of God learned too late that it is a fearful thing to have worn out the divine patience. The restraining Spirit of God, which imposes a check upon the cruel power of Satan, was in great measure removed, and he whose only delight is in the wretchedness of men was permitted to work his will. Those who had chosen the service of rebellion were left to reap its fruits until the land was filled with crimes too horrible for pen to trace. From devastated provinces and ruined cities, a terrible cry was heard, a cry of bitterest anguish. France was shaken as if by an earthquake. Religion, law, social order, the family, the state, and the church. All were smitten down by the impious hand that had been lifted against the law of God. Truly spoke the wise man, "The wicked shall fall by his own wickedness." Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him, but it shall not be well with the wicked. They hated knowledge, and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way, and be filled with their own devices. God's faithful witnesses, slain by the blasphemous power that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit, were not long to remain silent. After 3 days and a half, the Spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. It was in 1793 that the decrees which abolished the Christian religion and set aside the Bible passed the French Assembly. 3 years and a half later, a resolution reciting these decrees, thus granting toleration to the Scriptures, was adopted by the same body. The world stood aghast at the enormity of guilt which had resulted from a rejection of the sacred oracles, and men recognized the necessity of faith in God and His Word as the foundation of virtue and morality. Saith the Lord, "Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, behold, I will cause them to know. This once will I cause them to know, my hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is Jehovah." Concerning the two witnesses, the prophet declares further, "And they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, Come up hither. And they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them." Since France made war upon God's two witnesses, they have been honored as never before. In 1804, the British and Foreign Bible Society was organized. This was followed by similar organization with numerous branches upon the continent of Europe. In 1816, the American Bible Society was founded. When the British Society was formed, the Bible had been printed and circulated in 50 tongues. It has since been translated into many hundreds of languages and dialects. For the 50 years preceding 1792, little attention was given to the work of foreign missions. No new societies were formed, and there were but few churches that made any effort for the spread of Christianity in heathen lands. But toward the close of the 18th century, a great change took place. Men became dissatisfied with the results of rationalism and realized the necessity of divine revelation and experimental religion. From this time, the work of foreign missions attained an unprecedented growth. The improvements in printing have given an impetus to the work of circulating the Bible. The increased faculties for communication between different countries, the breaking down of ancient barriers and prejudice and national exclusiveness, and the loss of secular power by the Pontiff of Rome have opened the way for the entrance of the Word of God. For some years, the Bible has been sold without restraint in the streets of Rome, and it has now been carried to every part of the habitable globe. The infidel Voltaire once boastingly said, "I am weary of hearing people repeat that 12 men established the Christian religion. I will prove that 1 man may suffice to overthrow it." Generations have passed since his death. Millions have joined in the war upon the Bible. But it is so far from being destroyed that where there were 100 in Voltaire's time, there are now 10,000, yes, 100,000 copies of the Book of God. In the words of an early reformer concerning the Christian church, "The Bible is an anvil that has worn out so many hammers. Saith the Lord, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. The word of our God shall stand forever. All his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness. Whatever is built upon the authority of man will be overthrown, but that which is founded upon the rock of God's immutable word shall stand forever.